Thank you for checking out Random Musings from the Clinical Trials Guru. It really means a lot to me that you're listening to this podcast. If you listen and you like the content, then make sure you subscribe, make sure you leave a review. Please do that. And also go check me out on some of my other platforms. I have a long-running YouTube channel. I've got a blog, theclinicaltrialsguru.com. If you're interested in becoming a CRA or you're interested in getting a career in this industry, go to thecraacademy.com. If you're a research site owner interested in getting more studies for your site or negotiating better contracts for your site, go to my blog, theclinicaltrialsguru.com, and check it out. I offer consulting services. If you're a pharma, biotech, life sciences company, a CRO, I own a startup CRO, and we're here to help you, whatever it is you want. If you're a CRO, we can white label a lot of services for you. We have CRA coverage across the country at cost. We can do this at scale. If you're a pharma company, we are a full service CRO, and we're very confident in our pricing, and we are extremely competitive at bidding. And if you're also interested in your own digital marketing and leveraging a podcast maybe for yourself, reach out to me, dan@theclinicaltrialsguru.com. Again, thank you very much and enjoy the show. Hey everybody, welcome to episode 153 of Random Musings from the Clinical Trials Guru. I've got TJ Sharp on. TJ is a e-patient, is what they're called. He's basically somebody who learned about clinical research because he had to, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, TJ, but that's
mostly correct.
Yes. Mostly correct. We'll get into your story for sure, but I learned about you from this book, which I'm going to be interviewing Deborah soon. This book's about negotiating budgets for clinical trials, which people listening may or may not be interested right now, but that's where I learned about TJ. TJ wrote the foreword, and that's where I was like, oh, let me Twitter this guy and see, and sure enough, he was there, and he responded right away. In 2012, TJ was diagnosed with stage 4 melanoma. The first oncologist he went to offered their usual chemotherapy. They gave him 24 months to live. So what did you do after that? I mean, you looked for studies?
Yeah, actually, the first thing I looked for was one of the best, or the best doctor in my area, and I was able to have a few people help me. The tiny background with that, I actually worked in the pharmaceutical world as an IT guy, so I understood what clinical trials were.
So you knew about clinical trials already.
Mm-hmm. But they were for other people. They weren't for me until all of a sudden you're facing a stage 4 cancer diagnosis.
What were you doing? So, you said IT. What specifically were you doing?
I was doing, in the early part of my career, I was doing business analyst and project management work in the pharma field. I had since moved on and was an IT project manager in a couple different areas, not in pharma anymore. So that was a past life. But I remembered everything. I remembered how they functioned, the business behind them, the process of getting a drug from a preclinical environment to getting regulatory approval. So I knew the business part of it, and I learned very quickly about the patient part of it.
Yeah, which is the most important part, by the way. It's easy for us industry folks to lose sight of that, and this is why I'm bringing on more patients and a lot of cancer survivors. We just interviewed a breast cancer survivor. My CRO is working on a lot of cancer projects. So it's always great to get your experience. And now you go on the speaking route. You speak at conferences regularly or often enough, I guess?
Often enough that I am racking up the frequent flyer miles. I have a couple different. One is I tell the story, and we'll hear a little bit about it through Deborah's book and the challenges that I faced, both finding a trial and getting on a trial, and then finding the drug that was going to save my life and let me watch my kids grow up. When I was diagnosed, they were two years and 4 weeks old.
Right.
So that's it became a very very quickly I learned that the best treatments that I was going to find for melanoma weren't approved yet, but there was a lot of promise in the immunotherapy drugs that were coming through. But like a lot of other patients, roadblocks were preventing me from even looking for a trial or understanding where to find one. And then getting the trial started. So when we did look, initially it was for the best melanoma doctor in the area, and with the concept in the back of my mind that I didn't want that standard of care chemotherapy, and I wanted a clinical trial, not knowing what the best thing for me was. We just happened to find a really good research doctor who was at the cutting edge of cancer immunotherapy.
Interesting. So you were looking for the best doctor in your area. He happened to be getting into immunotherapy, which now, this was in 2012. So now, fast forward 6 years later, that's like the biggest area of cancer. We're doing that for my CRO right now. Immunotherapy is like what's going on right now in the world of cancer mm-hmm. research. So he recommended you do a study. Is that correct?
He gave me the option of two studies. One was an anti-PD-1 study, which I'm assuming many people on this have heard of, either Opdivo or Keytruda.
The two big ones.
But the second study he offered was really unique. It involved a couple different immunotherapies, and one process was called TIL, tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, which is really neat medicine. It's very specialized. It's very expensive. It's very similar to the CAR T cell therapies that have just been approved, and I was the first patient to ever try that series. So it was a first in human trial, and I was the first patient on the trial. So,
wow!
Which led to the patient number one blog title.
So you had a blog, patient number one. Now, in the foreword, you mentioned that you joined a study, or you were offered a study, but it was delayed, and it almost cost you your life.
That would be that first trial, the TIL trial, because it was first in human, because there was a couple different pharma companies, plus an IRB, plus the site, plus a private donor. The contract was taking forever to get signed. It was done. It wasn't that they were starting it from scratch. All my material was ready. My informed consent was signed. The drugs were actually at the hospital already, which is kind of a rare thing if a contract's not signed. But it was just that final, dotting I's and crossing T's, and it lasted for over a month. At some point, my doctor said we should move on to Plan B, and I said, no way, and you know what, that I was going to do that, because this was the best chance. He told me, I asked him, what did you think the best chance of me surviving this, for a long time is going to be? And he said, this trial. He said, I would do this if I were you. And I wasn't going to let the fact that a piece of paper was sitting there on someone's desk. So I made it happen myself.
How'd you make it happen?
And this could be just coincidence. I don't know. But I had a few friends that knew people in the two pharma companies involved. So I got on LinkedIn. And I found who they were, and had my friends give their buddies a call. But then I called one of the pharma companies myself, and in a very direct manner in which my Italian South Philly family is known, told them that no, I wasn't okay with them. They told me the document wasn't processed, and I said, it's not a document to me, it's my life, and I'm not going to wait for you to sign a document to see if I can live. And they kind of said, well, can you please hold for a few minutes? We'll have to call you back.
Let me get my supervisor.
Yep. So a couple of days later, they called the hospital and said, we're going to have the paper signed for you on Monday, for this man to start his study.
And by the way, like, these drug companies, at least on the research side, I don't know about on the sales side, I'm sure they do, but on the research side, these drug companies never get calls from patients, ever. So it's almost, they're not trained to speak with patients. So they don't really, they're trained to speak with people like me, who are from sites or CROs, and that we're talking contracts and budgets and whatever we're talking. But to hear from a patient, I mean, that must have been like a rude awakening for them, and certainly a first for them, whoever that person was that you were talking to.
Yeah, the line that I use, and I paraphrase what I said to the initial person that got the call, but I was like, I'm a cancer patient, and I have a concern about one of your clinical trial drugs. And that was the easiest way to get over to the legal department. They right away were like, okay, we need to put this guy in touch with someone at legal, because we're not going to touch this.
Wow. And so they put you in touch with legal, mm-hmm. and then with legal, you said, look, there's this contract at this hospital.
The woman who helped me, it wasn't a lawyer, it was one of the receptionists or the paralegals, and she was really, really, really nice. Mm. And she also had the company line. She was, you know, oh, I'm so sorry, that's terrible. Our documents aren't processed. And I'm like, it's not a bleeping document. This is my life. And I told her, I go, no, this is not okay. Do what you need to do, move mountains. But someone needs to sign that piece of paper. If it's already, you know, approved, but it's just waiting for a signature.
Wow.
Then get the damn signature on there and get it back to Moffitt so I can start my trial.
And you think because of your persistence that it got done quicker?
I kind of always thought maybe it did. And then when I started to really become involved in the industry and shared that story a couple of times, everyone seemed to assure me that most definitely it lit a fire under somebody because these things sit there and they wait for someone to get their job done. You know, hey, I get it. You and I probably do the same thing when it comes to responding to an email or to sending a budget template out. You know, a lot of times those things don't have that sense of urgency. But when it's a contract for a clinical trial to start, mm-hmm. and days can mean the difference between someone getting on a trial or not getting on.
Yeah. Potential life-saving. So the clock exactly was literally ticking for you at that moment in time, right?
Yep.
And was a placebo involved at all, or standard? Was it double-blind randomized, or were you guaranteed the immunotherapy?
No, this one was a phase one, so I was guaranteed the treatment. It was a couple of immunotherapies that were involved, and they used the TIL part right in the middle of it, which involved surgery. I actually had two surgeries. Including getting a colostomy bag, which is kind of a not study-related side effect.
Yeah.
They needed to make sure that the bacteria, I had a diverticulitis, just really bad luck. Hmm. And it had a part of the process is lymphodepleting me, so taking all my white blood cells basically out with leukemia drugs. And if they would have done that, the bacteria pretty much would have killed me. So it was a number of different processes, and it was complicated. So I understand taking your time on a contract, but what I didn't understand was, hey, this is, you know, we're all getting the drug here, so we know what protocol processes are going to happen. Let's get this started. luckily it worked. I mean, luckily the contract I started, I actually failed the trial and moved on to a second one.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yes.
So what happened in the trial? Well, how did you fail?
Tumors continued to grow. A few of the tumors responded to the trial combination. So my oncologist, a very, really smart man named Jeff Weber, he walked in and said, "You know, I'm a little confused about your trial, your scan results." And I'm like, "Well, if you're confused, what the heck do you think I am?" he said, "Look, you know, there's a potential that the drugs are working. It's just taking a long time. But more have shown up, and the bigger ones are getting bigger. That's a hallmark, you know, especially of, you know, Yervoy, the first real immunotherapy approved for melanoma. That was something that happened." But he goes, "You know, we don't have the time to wait to see if it's going to happen or not, because if it's not the drug working and your tumors really are getting bigger, you don't have much time left. You need to get on Plan B as soon as possible."
So what was Plan B? Another study?
Yes, I ended up on the second ever Keynote trial for what's now known as Keytruda. So that was I was the first person to do the first trial and probably one of the first 500 people to get pembrolizumab on a clinical trial.
And with that one, was that the one that you saw success?
Yes, it initially we saw great success. A year into it, there was an adrenal tumor that sort of stopped, became resistant to the drug. Mm. But when they took that out, we did a PET scan, and we realized that that was the only active cancer that was showing up on the PET scan. So we were fairly confident that the drug not only was working, but had really wiped out almost all the melanoma that was in my body. Mm. You know, they came with a lot of caveats that you know, melanoma is resistant, and it's, you know, it's a sneaky little bastard. So, you know, I'm still on the study. I continued to take the drug for another 2 years after that.
Wow. So how long was that study?
There was no defined endpoint, which is kind of odd. When I read the informed consent, I remember thinking, hey, what happens if I get better here? Like, do we ever stop?
Yeah.
And they hadn't, because it was so new, they had intentionally not written in an endpoint. They wanted to leave it open. Merck has now reconsented me a number of times, one being saying that if you're on the drug for so many months and you have a stable disease or a complete response, you can come off the drug, but you'll still stay on the trial. So that's what I've since done. I was on the drug for about 4.5 years.
Wow.
At which time it went through three different name changes from, you know, from its, you know, initial indication, MK-3475, to, you know, to eventually its trademark Keytruda brand name. Mm-hmm. And I had 75 doses, which is among the highest number. You know, the unconfirmed highest number was in the 80s that someone had on clinical trial.
Wow. What are you supposed to get, every 4 weeks, or how does that work?
Every 3 weeks. Every three weeks. They eventually standardized it. At one point, there was a low and a high dose arm. So going back to the placebo part, there was a standard care arm in the second trial that was chemotherapy. So there was a third low dose, a third high dose, and a third chemo. I don't know which one of the two doses I received, but I know I was on the study drug. And they eventually came up with a standard dose after the approval by the FDA. So that's what I got for the last, I want to say, 25 or 30 doses.
Wow.
Until we decided to stop.
And you decided to stop because the tumors were gone?
We had a number of clean CT scans. Mm-hmm. That I consider clean, but on the trial itself, I was actually considered a partial responder with stable disease. There were still two spots that kept showing up over and over again, but they didn't change. And with a CT, you only measure size. You can't tell if that's scar tissue. You know, one of the spots was on my spleen, and it went from a 10 or 11 centimeter tumor to, you know, maybe 3 centimeters it measured across. And they said, we just don't know, without taking a biopsy, which we don't think is a good idea for you right now.
Yeah.
So we eventually had a PET and a CT together, and the radiologist put in his report that malignant disease is not suspected. And that was the first time someone told me that they didn't think I had cancer.
Mm-hmm. Are you taking any medications now for...
No, I've been off the trial. I've been off the medication for 9 months or so.
Wow. Okay.
Two scans have been clear. You know, other than those two spots still show up, and everyone seems to consider them non-cancerous.
Okay.
As long as they're not growing, I don't care. At this point, for me, a tie is a win. So if they just stay the way that they are, I'll take it.
Right. Good. And then so good for you. And then you're still in the study. They're just following up. On you and on, yeah. I guess, long-term safety and long-term efficacy. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So you've really become, I guess, a voice for the patients, and your background's unique because you worked in the pharma industry, then you became a patient, so you saw firsthand the inefficiencies, which, by the way, are many. Incredible. You know, it cost over $1 million per day for a clinical trial. And that's mostly because of patient recruitment or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's nuts.
Yeah. And so when you go to these conferences now, you go as a patient. There's a whole movement now in pharma for patient centricity. It's sort of a buzzword, which nobody really understands what it means. I certainly don't.
Yes.
What does that mean to you? And why are they using this term?
Well, they're using it because it's what everybody else is using. This is a copycat industry. So as soon as one organization starts saying, we're going to be patient-centric, and there was that good buzz, everyone wanted to be patient-centric. And I think you're absolutely right when you say that no one really knows what it means, or it means something different to everybody. So when I'm out, you know, on the speaking tour, or when I'm either presenting my story, or when I'm working on a panel, mm-hmm. my continual message is that patients are looking out for their own health. They are actively involved. They are finding each other. There is a network of patients, no matter what disease state, that are going to connect to each other.
Yes.
And you have two options. You can embrace that and make and sort of rising tide float all the boats thing, or you can stick your head in the sand, you know, and be the ostrich that says, all right, we can't do anything with patients because we're not supposed to, by some interpretation of FDA stuff that our legal team tells us.
Mm-hmm.
It's really
that which is outdated is really, and written prior to social media.
Yes, much. And the FDA and Scott Gottlieb and his team are changing the way that perception is. They are actively pushing the message out there that no, you know, this is what you should be doing. This is the guidance we're going to give you. And it's not that you can't talk to patients. Yeah, that's the easy, I'll call it the lazy way of saying it. And it's been hammered into that industry for 20 or 30 years. So people aren't used to saying,
is it because of the whole SAE thing? Like, it's just easier for them to ignore patients reporting potential SAEs as opposed to engaging with them? Because that's what their concern is.
It's a component of that. I think the, you know, even for me to get a chance to work with some of the companies that I've taken their drug took serious hurdle, you know, overcoming serious hurdles. And there's a difference between any patient saying anything, which you go back to social media, you know, if you start following along with patients and something comes up, well, now you're submitting paperwork for every adverse event you read on Twitter. I understand why those, you know, fail safes are in place, but now it's what is happening now is it's preventing, especially the bigger companies that are worried about not just that process, but them being liable for not reporting or having to go over all of these SAEs. It gets to be a conundrum where it's better for them not to, you know, have their ear to the door, so mm-hmm. to speak.
Keep the door closed, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to change. I'm myself with a number of other patients and advocacy organizations are trying to change that perspective. So we are a valued stakeholder in this process. You are starting to tell people that you are patient-centric, how do you say that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but you're patient-centric. Actually not really, that's it.
Yeah.
Patient-centricity is a nice buzzword, but it's not really a core value. There's not action behind it. Or you're defining the action. So when you say you're patient-centric, you're telling patients what you want from them. And I think that's the wrong way to look at it, that
right.
You should be listening. You know, the two examples I use all the time, you know, I will put up the word, I'll put up partners and customers. And I don't say customers, other patients, some of them don't like that word, but in the end, we're all consumers of the healthcare industry.
Sure.
And if you're gonna treat me like, with very poor customer service, you're going to get what we've got for the last 20, 30, 40 years in clinical research. When companies in the pharma world and the CRO world start becoming the Amazons or the Netflix or the Cadillacs of healthcare, well, the customers are going to respond to that. And it's not just because you have a good drug. It's because you're getting better medical treatment. You're getting more advanced care.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting more consistent care. You're monitored more. And I continually push that, especially in the clinical research world, that if you want to avoid those $1 million days of patients not enrolling in your trial,
it's pushing $2 million a day now. By the way,
wow! And how hard is it to make it the best option? How little of an investment to recoup that $1 or $2 million a day would it take to make a clinical trial someone's preferred option? Maybe not the best option every time, but in that top, you know, in that top tier box, if you want to talk, well, this is what you should do right away. Well, we want to make clinical trials the thing that the first option you look to is, all right, well, what's in trial? Because I know I'm going to get the best treatment there. I'm going to get the best customer service, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. They will get that. And in oncology is sort of different because there really is no placebo. You're either getting the experimental treatment or the standard of care. So
yeah,
there's only a upside, really. And if you're not in an oncology study, let's say you're in an asthma trial, you very well could get placebo. Or we do a lot of psychiatry trials. Patient with psychosis could get placebo. And so there is a risk there. But you're absolutely right about the better care that they're getting. It may not be getting any treatment, but they're getting so much more oversight from medical staff and so much more medical care that it almost makes up for it. And then if they're not doing well, they can get put back on a current standard of treatment. So they learn more about themselves in the process too. And that's the worst that could happen. The best is that they get the drug and it works for them. Or they get the drug and it doesn't work for them, or it gives them some weird side effect, which the researchers have not discovered yet. So there's a lot of different scenarios that can occur, but cancer is a totally different world, and you're absolutely right there. I mean, that should be one of the first places patients go. It's unfortunate that they're not going there. So that's, I guess that's why pharma is trying to engage you. How many have wanted to work with you and share your story with their, I guess, help build up their brand?
A number. I have to remember what kind of NDAs I have with some of them. I would say the first level I actually have worked at. I mean, I've worked with individual pharma companies. I've spoken in a number of places, but the overriding or overarching company that I work for or work with is Transcelerate. I don't know how familiar you are with them or the listeners are, but they are a consortium of biotech and pharma companies that are trying to elevate the clinical trial world with a number of different work streams.
Absolutely. I never knew they worked with the patients. So how are they working with you?
I am engaged. There's right now two active patient-facing work streams, and I am engaged with both of them. So I am on the calls. I go to the face-to-face meetings, and my role, initially my role was just be the patient voice here. One of the things that I feel I bring well is it's not just the TJ Sharp story. It's not even just the melanoma cancer the melanoma story or the cancer patient stories, but it is, like you said, there. It's the asthma patients, or it is the one of the things we had was just a mock patient advisory board for lupus. So to bring those different perspectives in, I try to listen as much as I can when I go to these meetings to the other patient stories and bring those insights with me. So my role becomes being that voice to the industry, whether I bring it to a specific company as they're designing a trial or they want to listen to this to a story, or as the Transcelerate team works collaboratively to now bring clinical research better. I get to bring that voice to them.
So are they on their teams? Are they trying to get a patient's perspective on how they're designing the study? Like, hey, do you feel like you'll be compliant or you would be compliant with this aspect of the protocol?
No, it's more the two work streams I worked on. The one that's real active right now is a patient protocol engagement toolkit. So there's a number of things that are on that, but it's how member companies and the industry at large would engage patients in a protocol design, where to engage them, how to engage them. And I've been sort of the patient voice on that. We have,
I mean, like where to recruit them or?
No. How to engage patients in the protocol design. So patients like me an advisory board or
so
other
high level stuff.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So getting them involved from the initial design of the study, all the way through protocol redesigns or amendments and
what's the
consent.
What's the rationale for that? Is it because the patients are experts in the condition, or because not all patients are? I mean, it's actually the minority of patients are actually experts in their medical condition, but is it more from a perspective of compliance on the protocol, or
it's everything? That's one of the factors. What the toolkit is looking to do is to allow member companies to give we don't use the word guideline, but to give some insight into how to engage informed patients, educated patients, not the whole patient population, but ones like myself or other e-patients that are empowered to look at a protocol, to work with a company and say, when you design this protocol, you can't have this many blood draws, or you're asking someone to come 3 times a week that may have kids or maybe elderly and might not have a way to get there. It's the little parts
gotcha.
that And the industry does a really good job of trying to think through things, but too often, unless you've kind of walked the walk, it's not easy. And I'm sure you've seen it before where something in a trial sounded great until you actually went to implement it, and you couldn't recruit because of it, or you had a lower
Research clinics. I own a few research clinics, mostly in the central nervous system disorders, so schizophrenia, Alzheimer's. And some of these protocols are, you can tell they're designed in ivory towers, because when they present the protocol to us at the site selection visits, the doctors and the staff tell them there's no way any one of our real world patients are going to be compliant on this protocol. Like, none of them. So go back and rethink it.
And how much time and money is that costing patients and pharma companies every single day?
Yeah. Oh, close to $2 million a day now.
So that's one of the projects I work on. Another one, we did a prototype for a registry of the future, something that would be akin to clinicaltrials.gov, and how to make it not just more usable, not kind of paving the cow path, but coming up with a design that would truly make it the tool that it's being used for now, because it's almost exclusively accessed by physicians looking for trials and patients looking for trials. But it's still a database. It's a database of results and trials that are open.
So this will be separate from CT.gov? It's something separate Transcelerate's doing?
Right now, it's not. Transcelerate isn't going to actually build it. We've built the prototype. We are now in the process of building what creating what we're calling the data packets for a common registry. And what it looks to do is to get that back end data that's going to be needed for a registry to not just be a dumping grounds for data, but to be a useful tool. So being able to get the right types of data points in there. In oncology, started going down to more towards genetic markers, you're a mutation type. Well, guess what? When I go in there, I want to search BRAF. That's the melanoma mutation. I'm trying to figure out which studies I'm eligible for because I was a wild type BRAF and certain therapies don't work for me. But to do that, there's no filter. The technologies are there. It's not hard to do.
So you want to get very granular with your search, not just search for melanoma on clinicaltrials.gov.
You want the overarching concept behind it is we want to make the tool more effective. Mm-hmm. And if that means for patients who don't have the background knowledge or doctors that do but are going to look for very, very specific things, they should both be able to use the tool with equal ease, and equal efficiency is probably the better word to put it, because it's not just ease of using it, but also that you find the right trial, you find the right options. Someone like me, we were fortunate. We had a very flexible situation. We could relocate our family for a few months from Fort Lauderdale to Tampa, and it wasn't a big deal. Other people have to stick it within a certain area or have a lot of other things that will hold them back from being able to just look anywhere for a trial. And there's the geographic limitation. There is the type of trial it is. When you start looking at non-cancer treatments, where people are still living their lives, they can't take 8 hours a week to go to
to
a treatment center.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So how close are we to getting a registry like this? Because, first of all, how effective is clinicaltrials.gov?
Well, I'm an IT guy and a fairly educated person, but we had a hard time with it. And even to the point where my second trial, I wasn't the one that found it. The first trial we found because we went to a good doctor and he recommended the trial. By the point in time I was looking for a second trial, I knew enough about CT.gov to go on there and search. I'd actively done it, and I didn't find the trial that I ended up on. The person who found it was a melanoma advocate for the Melanoma International Foundation, and she said there's a trial for, instead of 4 hours from your house, about 4 miles from your house. We are not very close.
So you weren't able to find that study on your own. It had to come from someone else.
No. What probably happened was I got, here's a list of 179 results that you're going to see on CT.gov and go, how the hell do I get down to the right one for me?
Yeah.
Now, Catherine was a great advocate. She knew what to look for. She knew that she wanted to find an anti-PD-1 trial, so she was able to narrow it down to, the two drugs and narrow down a location And the trial, the results were much better, more relevant because she had the smarts behind doing it.
Yeah.
But most people don't.
The average patient's not going to know how to do that. First of all, you're lucky enough if they even know about clinicaltrials.gov or about clinical trials in general. Forget about clinicaltrials.gov. Fascinating. There's a lot of work to do in this space. It's no wonder that pharma companies are getting you involved and having you speak. And I just interviewed another e-patient, and you're absolutely right. In this case, she's a breast cancer survivor, and she created this Facebook private group where she's attracting, you know, the informed patients, the empowered patients to join. And these are educated people. Some of them are doctors, and they're sharing strategies with each other. So it's a private group. Exactly what Transcelerate's looking for, actually. So there's a lot of these groups popping up everywhere, but no one's telling them to do it. It's just something that they want to do. And if pharma wants to engage, they can. She's never been engaged by any pharma company. We're working with her for an investigator-initiated trial I'm working on, but that's about it. And that's serendipitously because the PI, she found the PI because she was doing her research on who the good oncologists are in her area. So they're out there. It's just a matter of making this the new normal and getting patients engaged in study design, and then getting these influential patients, like yourself, like many others, advocates, they call them, to share their knowledge on clinical research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's we're out there, and we're getting louder and louder. The changes, when that paradigm shift happens, and it will happen, it's probably not going to come from one of the big pharma guys. It's going to come from a smaller company that is a little more agile and can adopt this. In a conference 2 weeks ago, someone asked me what clinical trials were going to be in 5 years. and my answer was, there's going to be someone, and hopefully this happens in the next 5 years, that takes the concept of a clinical trial as it exists right now and turns it on its head and starts with the patient and goes out to a community like that, the breast cancer community, and says, hey, how do we design our trial the best for breast cancer? And they start from there. And then, they have to plug in how they need to get regulatory approval and worry about how they're going to label stuff and all the adverse events. But if you start with the concept of truly being patient-centric and work from there, instead of trying to shoehorn patient opinions in here and there, it will change the way the trials are structured. It will change the way the trials are design in a protocol, and hopefully it will change the way that they're executed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we're not going to get into blockchain, but I think blockchain technology will have a huge role in this and making trials more efficient. If we find a way, and we're probably 10 years away from this, but getting the majority of patients to opt in, sharing their data, de-identified, and they're getting compensated for it through some kind of crypto, they'll be able to run these trials, at least the preliminary trials, virtually quicker, and be able to see the results prior to doing the actual trial on subjects. So, fascinating stuff. The industry is going to change one way or another, probably for the better. And thank you very much, TJ, for coming on and sharing your story. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. I hope you guys out there enjoyed Deborah's book. It was wonderful to be able to write a foreword. And it's nice that she's doing something to really address an issue that not only I face, but others out there face. So thanks for having me on. Look forward to hearing the next podcast you guys do.
Absolutely. And where can people find you? I found you on Twitter. Where do you want people to find you?
I am all over the place. The best place to find me is Twitter. It's at Team TJ Sharp. It's SHARPE. And Facebook, facebook.com/patient1, NUMBER, and then the number one.
Wow. So
those are the two places to find me.
Very good. Yeah. Very good branding there. Thank you again, TJ. We'll have you on again. Good luck with everything, and hope I run into you at one of these conferences.
That sounds good, Dan. Looking forward to it.
All right. Take care.
Take it easy.
So hey everybody, thank you very much for listening to another episode of Random Musings from the Clinical Trials Guru. Again, if you haven't already, make sure you subscribe to this podcast. Make sure you leave a review, if you could be so kind, please. And also go to theclinicaltrialsguru.com if you're interested in learning more about who I am, who some of my guests are. You can have access to some of my YouTube videos. I do a lot of videos about clinical research. So go to theclinicaltrialsguru.com. And you can also call or text me anytime, 949-415-6256. Also follow me on any social media platform. It's Dan Svera. And you can also email me if you'd like, dan@theclinicaltrialsguru.com. Thank you very much.